The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armond presiding.
Morning, counsel. We'll call case number 4-22-0370, Kenneth Hartery versus Glenn Menschhofer. I hope I'm pronouncing those names correctly. If counsel for the appellant, could you please state your name for the record?
Matt Heffelfinger. From Chartwell Law, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Heffelfinger. I understand you'll be starting the argument, and then Mr. Barnett will take the last 5 minutes. Is that correct?
True, Your Honor. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And counsel for the appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Judge. My name is Thaddeus Gustafson.
Thank you, gentlemen. Counsel for the appellant, you may please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I want to jump right, I think, to the guts of the issue here, and it gets to the inspection of the 2005 Buick on December 7, 2017, and the fact that there is a failed weld discovered. And if we jump to Judge Baber's order of January 4, 2022, paragraph 9, he basically says that it, at the very end, that Crum Trucking knew or should have known on or shortly after December 7 that Hartery was injured and that the weld on the seat had broken. The problem with the court's analysis in this particular matter is the court failed to recognize the why. When at the inspection that occurred December 7, 2017, we knew that there was a failed weld. The question is, was it an original seat? Was it an OEM replacement? Was it a junkyard seat? When was the welding work performed? Who may have done it? All those questions remained unanswered. The Guzman case, which we cite from the Illinois Supreme Court, specifically says that there's no pre-suit duty on behalf of a defendant, that the statute under 13204 begins to run upon service. In this particular case, the defendants were left with a situation where they knew that there was a failed weld. And then once suit was filed, efforts were undertaken, trying to figure out what, if any, cause of action may exist relative to that failed weld. And I think it's important that we talk about some cases that speak, I think, to the issue here that we're really trying to address. And interestingly, the Knox College versus Celotex case from the Supreme Court in 1981, which originated out of Galesburg, Knox County, involved the construction of a campus building. And once it was finished in 1970, it began to leak. Well, if you take the position taken by Judge Baber in this matter, as well as the appellee, when the roof began leaking, the statute of limitation should have begun to run. That was enough. However, the Supreme Court said that Knox College did not know until November 1976 when an independent consultant advised them that the roof problems may have been caused by the Celotex roofing system. And what's interesting about the case, I think, is that the case speaks to a spectrum of knowledge. And I want to quote certain portions of the case on page 415. We have held that the event which triggers the running of the statutory period is not the first knowledge the injured person has of his injury. And at the other extreme, we have also held that it is not the acquisition of knowledge that one has a cause of action against another for an injury he has suffered. Rather, we have held that the statute starts to run when a person knows or reasonably should know of his injury and also knows or reasonably should have known that it was wrongfully caused. And at page 417, the discussion from the court, I think, is very instructive here to the issues before us here today. And it says, it is true that Knox knew that the roof leaked almost as soon as it was completed. Trial court found this was sufficient to alert Knox College of the fact that something was wrong. We cannot say as a matter of law, however, that the event started the running of the limitation period. Evidence may disclose that build-up roofs of this type often leak following installation due to some minor defects in the application material, which are usually easily corrected. It may be the nature of the leak and not and the fact that the subcontractor undertook it once to remedy if it were facts which would not cause a reasonable person to investigate further. However, this is the important part. If not for the first leak, at some point along the line, Knox had sufficient information to put a reasonable person on inquiry as to the nature of the defect in the roof and whether a cause of action existed in favor of Knox. That point must be determined by the trier fact, and it must determine whether that information was acquired during the five-year property damage statute of limitation. In that particular case, the Illinois Supreme Court said that they knew once, Knox College knew once they had information from an independent consultant, 6 years after the roof was leaking from rainwater. I want to talk also about the LaManna versus G.D. Serling Company case, because the three cases I want to focus on speak to, I think, the issues associated with the spectrum. And I think the spectrum is important here because we get to the issue of why. In the first district in LaManna in 1990, looked at a claim from a female that she became infertile as a result of an infection associated with the use of an IUD. And anyway, the question was when did she know that the claim may exist against a product manufacturer? And the court said that suspicion is not the same as reasonably knowing. The limitation statute is not triggered during the period that a party is attempting to discover whether her injury is wrongfully caused, but rather it is triggered at the point when the party reasonably should have known that her injury was wrongfully caused. Again, it speaks to the spectrum.
Mr. Heffelfinger, can I interrupt sure. your yes, presentation sir. Here with a question? And I'll just throw out a hypothetical. Sure. Let's say you have two cars that collide in a head-on collision. The at-fault driver is sued. The other car, the airbag doesn't deploy, results in serious injuries or death to the driver of the other vehicle. Very apparent that the collision was one which should have activated the airbag, should have resulted in its deployment, but it didn't happen. And everybody knows, they're aware of that fact. It's a readily apparent fact. Now, even though they know that, there hasn't been a determination as to why the airbag didn't deploy. And there could be several reasons why it didn't. It could have been a manufacturing defect. It could have been an aftermarket modification that was made, or a deliberate elimination of the airbag feature or a sensor. In any event, in that situation, at what point does the discovery rule start? At what point is the defendant who's been sued for the collision itself, at what point is that defendant then facing a two-year discovery rule clock?
I think that's a great question. And I think fundamentally the answer to that question is going to be determined based upon the circumstances of that particular situation. The first question obviously that would have to be addressed is who manufactured the airbag, correct? And then the issues attendant to, you know, why the failure may have occurred or not occurred. But I think
does Knox College, and I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, that's okay.
Does Knox College indicate that those are questions that have to be answered, or those are facts that have to be gleaned before the discovery rule, kicks in, or the discovery rule kicks in? Or is it just simply enough that the parties are aware that something failed? And that is the operative fact that starts the running of the 2 years.
I think the something failed is a point, but I don't think that's the trigger point. I think the trigger point has to be at some point after that. Just because something failed doesn't necessarily mean there may be a cause of action. There has to be requisite knowledge that would exist. And the question is, where along the spectrum does that exist? And that's why I go back to Knox College, because here they had an independent consultant that told them that the reason it was leaking is because of Celotex's product, and that was 6 years after the leaking started.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Please.
Okay. And I also want to just talk briefly about the Young versus McKeague case, which is a first district case out of 1999. And that was a gentleman passed away after approximately 8 days after being admitted to the hospital. They got it was a malpractice matter. There were two expert reports. The second expert report basically said that the decedent died from a cardiac arrest. There was then an attempt to add Dr. McKeague, certainly 2 years beyond the time frame. And I think this case is important because, again, it speaks to the spectrum and it speaks to the issue of trigger. And in page 390 of that opinion, the court said the statute is not triggered during the period in which the party is attempting to discover whether her injury is actionable. Instead, limitations period commences when the party possesses enough information concerning her injury to apprise a reasonable person to the need for further inquiry to determine whether a legal wrong has been committed. Suspecting wrongdoing is not the same as knowing that a wrong was probably committed. Whether a party possesses the requisite knowledge contemplates an objective analysis of the factual circumstances involved. The focus is on what a reasonable person would have known under the circumstances, not on what the particular party suspected. I think this is important because it gets back to, Your Honor, at some level, your question is posed to me. And the question is, it speaks to, at what point do you have the requisite knowledge to be able to for that statute to trigger? And I think that's going to be a case-by-case approach. It's clear, based on all the cases that have been cited in the briefs, that every case rises and falls somewhat on its facts. So here, you know, when we look at, you know, the Judge Baber cites the Nolan case, but the Nolan case, the facts support the appellants in this matter. In terms of the period of time that he had worked around asbestos as an asbestos insulator. And then the question is when did the running of the statute of limitation trigger? And the court said, in that particular case, it's a question of fact. And I think what's important here in this particular setting is that just discovering the fact that, say, an airbag did not deploy, that's not the why. That's something that leads us to ask the question of why. And then the question becomes, when do you acquire that requisite knowledge? And Guzman tells us that we don't have some duty pre-suit to engage in some anticipatory relief designed to try to figure out who may be responsible or why this occurred. The why is what's important here. But the thing about it is, even if we did, ask yourselves what we would have discovered in this matter. We would have gotten records that basically don't identify that the seat was welded, records that don't identify that the seat was replaced. The record in question is dated April 5, 2015. It says that the seat track was repaired. And their argument that we should have taken depositions, that's akin to arguing. In a situation, let's say that there's some type of there's a railroad accident, and they're saying that if the railroad track was, the documents say the railroad track was repaired, that somehow we have an affirmative duty to then take depositions that speak to what may have occurred with respect to the locomotive itself. There was no good faith basis for us to take any depositions based upon the documents. And I think it's interesting, just, you know, it's in the record, but when they even answered the third party complaint, they couldn't even admit that they replaced the seat. They said upon information and belief, I'm talking about the appellee. So the first time we had any knowledge that would answer the why was when we took Mr. Hardery's deposition, which for the record is clear, was delayed because of COVID. We'd have taken that deposition in May per court order. In May, And then this would not be before your honors here today. So in the end, we think this is clearly a question of fact. We think that at some level, the conduct of Steve Smith and Alan Garage in terms of the lack of information from its record keeping and the ultimate deposition testimony that they replaced the seat, and the only thing that needed to be done for them was to turn the seat upside down, and they could have seen the bad weld that was on the seat that they replaced. These are fact questions that need to be addressed by a jury in this matter. We believe that this is a miscarriage of justice to allow this order to stand from Judge Baber. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heffelfinger. Mr. Barnett, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it may please the court, co-counsel, opposing counsel, I think it's important to emphasize here that analyzing when a person knows that an injury both occurred and was wrongfully caused are questions of fact to be resolved by the jury. And the district court here improperly resolved the questions of fact that are supposed to be for the jury on a motion to dismiss. Mere suspicion that there was a wrongdoing or that the injury may have been wrongfully caused is insufficient to trigger the statute of limitations as a matter of law as set forth by the cases that my co-counsel cited in his opening remarks. In addition to the cases that my co-counsel cited, I'd like to bring to the court's attention the Nolan v. Johns Mansville asbestos case from the Illinois Supreme Court, which my co-counsel did point out Judge Baber actually relied upon, but favors the appellants here. In that case, the plaintiff, Nolan, he knew that he had lung issues and health issues from his lungs for a period of years. In fact, he even went so far to get an x-ray that confirmed that he had lung issues. Subsequent to that x-ray, he was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis. Then, after that diagnosis, he was diagnosed officially with asbestosis, which a doctor informed him was a result of working in and around asbestos. The Illinois Supreme Court held in that case that it could not, as a matter of law, determine that even though the plaintiff had lung issues and health issues from his lungs for years, that the statute of limitations triggered when he first got that x-ray confirming that he had lung issues. The Illinois Supreme Court held it could not determine as a matter of law that the statute of limitations triggered when he was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis. Instead, the Illinois Supreme Court held there was a question of fact. A question of fact as to whether the plaintiff in that case reasonably knew that his injury was wrongfully caused by his exposure to asbestos in his workplace. And interestingly, with the Knox case, that case, it was decided on a motion to dismiss, and the Illinois Supreme Court reversed the district court decision to affirm dismissal. And as noted by co-counsel, the mere fact that there was leakage immediately after the roof was constructed was insufficient as a matter of law to determine that the statute of limitations triggered, because the evidence may show that that type of defect is customary and may be rectified in a quick manner. Here, on a motion to dismiss, the district court decided questions of fact that are supposed to be reserved for the jury. And in doing so, the district court essentially imposed the same statute of limitations on the defendants in this case as plaintiff would have to bring a claim against Smith and Allen Garage. And that's improper. And it's improper because plaintiff knew all of the underlying facts. Plaintiff knew that he had his one, he knew that he sat on his seat and that the seat broke. He knew that afterwards, he then took his seat to Smith and Allen Garage and asked them to weld it. He then knew that he went back to Smith and Allen Garage and had them replace his seat. And plaintiff received invoices in connection with all that work and knew or should have known what those invoices meant. Mm-hmm. Plaintiff knew the who, what, when, where, why, and how. We did not have that information. So this goes back to the airbag hypothetical. If the plaintiff in that case knew that they had their airbag worked upon or replaced, if the defendant in that case sent them discovery, one would expect that the plaintiff would say, hey, here's where I got my repairs done. Here's the work to the airbag. We sent discovery requests asking plaintiff to identify repair work. He said he could not remember, he did not have invoices, and at the time he's living in an assisted living facility. He then referred to us to 4 repair shops. We sent subpoenas to those repair shops. We got the invoice records. When we're asking plaintiff in his deposition to identify when and where he got his seat welded, he can't tell us. He describes the invoices as being cryptic. Well, this is the individual who had the work done. This is the individual who paid for those invoices. And he can't tell us when or where he had his seat welded. And he agrees that there's nothing in those invoices that shows that his seat was even welded in the first place. When we show those same invoices to Smith and Allen Garage representatives and the technician who welded and subsequently replaced plaintiff's seat, he agrees. There's nothing in those invoices that show that the seat was welded. So,
Mr. Barman, could I interrupt you? Does the record demonstrate what the speeds of the vehicles were at the time of the collision?
I believe that may be in the Semsky record, in the appellate record, but I'm not 100% sure whether the speed of the vehicles are actually set forth in the record.
In terms of the record, what's in the record for us to consider, can you characterize the nature of the collision?
Yes. Yeah, so plaintiff was traveling down the highway. He's going about 50 miles per hour, and our semi-truck driver going the speed limit at 60 rear-ends him. And from there, plaintiff's vehicle then continues down the road, ends up in the ditch, and goes over a median. But okay.
What did plaintiff's vehicle collide with?
Our truck driver.
Came to rest.
Pardon me?
Yes, what did plaintiff's vehicle collide with when it ultimately came to rest?
It didn't collide with anything, Your Honor. It came to rest in the median. It stayed upright. It didn't flip over or anything like that.
Okay.
But it did go over the median quickly, and it looked like it was impactful on the vehicle, on the shocks.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barnett. Your time is up. You'll have an opportunity in rebuttal. Mr. Gustafson. You're on mute, Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Judge, it seems like there's a lot of focus, and there should be, on the inspection of the vehicle. And then we have in the record the Semke forensic report. And that report, the examination of the vehicle was performed on December 7, 2017. And it was attended by the plaintiff's counsel and counsel for the defendant from Trucking and Mentroffer. And it was also attended by their retained engineering consultant, in addition to the plaintiff's engineering consultant. And in this report, we have pictures of the vehicle, we have description of the accident, and we also have information as to what was done at that inspection. And in particular, it is at the request of from Trucking's expert consultant that the driver's seat be disassembled so that the seat cushion can be exposed and the seat frame can be exposed, because they know from the accident and looking at the car that the seat has been displaced rearward. They have all this information. Their expert says, I need to tear the seat apart so we can examine it. And when he tears it apart and examines it, and we have photographs, we see that in the report that there is a fracture, there's a weld on the seat frame that is fractured in addition to another weld. And the report concludes that disassembly of the driver's seat revealed that the lower right and left seat connections were previously welded. This is knowledge they had at the time of the inspection with their expert there. That knowledge carries over to when defense counsel appeared in this case.
Could you restate that again? Sure. Could you restate that again in terms of what the evidence was? You said that evidence that it was previously welded.
Yes.
Well, does that mean that was not a factory weld, but it was demonstrating it had been re-welded?
Yes, Judge. Well, it doesn't go into particulars about that, but these are experts in attendance. They would know and should know about the ability to obtain, you know, information about the vehicle and their parts and everything else. And I think it's pretty basic knowledge that a seat frame is one unit that is not welded. And when you look at this photograph, you can see in this report that the weld, that there's a weld on the frame. There should be one solid piece. There's a weld there, and that's where the fracture occurs. And
well, what evidence is there in the record supporting what you just said, that it's basic knowledge that this shouldn't have been welded, that it was apparent that this was something that happened after the fact?
Well, at that point, I mean, all I can tell you, Your Honor, is that the report states disassembly of the driver's seat, and this is at page 9 of the Semke report, disassembly of the driver's seat revealed the lower right and left seat connections were previously welded. However, the fractured lower right seat connection was caused by the rear end collision. So they note that there was a previous weld made to the frame of this seat.
Part of what he's asking, I think, is who among us knows, and is it common knowledge, that welds like that don't occur in the original manufacturing process? I think that's what Justice Harris is asking in terms of what in the record shows that that is so self-evident that it becomes, what, a matter of judicial notice or common knowledge? I certainly don't know that.
Well, Judge, I think that we have to look at this in the situation, in the facts of this particular case. We have two mechanical engineers who are present and who tear apart the seat and document there's a previous weld. They are also
weld if it happened in Detroit.
I'm sorry?
It would be a previous weld if it happened in Detroit when it was originally manufactured. That's the fact behind this observation of the engineers. And maybe they could have said, you know, this isn't original manufacturing. This was done previously, means before. It doesn't tell you when before.
Right, but it gives you the information of a wrongful cause. We know that there's a weld that is fractured. We know that it's in this condition following the accident. So that the defendant is on notice that there is a problem with this seat frame and that it was previously welded and it broke at that point where the weld was at.
Well, the evidence establishes the point of failure, but you equate that with wrongful causation. But is it dependent on the forces involved? And I was asking earlier about the speeds involved. If you had two vehicles colliding head on at 70 miles an hour each, it might be much more plausible that a seat frame could separate from its point of attachment, just simply by nature of the extreme forces involved. And that wouldn't necessarily point to being wrongfully caused. Whereas if you had a relatively minor collision with not nearly as much force involved, and if the seat became detached, then you could more clearly identify it as having occurred wrongfully. So is that getting then into a fact question that Mr. Heffelfinger, Mr. Barnett were discussing?
Well, Judge, I don't think it really matters, because what matters is that there is a fractured weld and that they've determined that the seat frame was previously welded and now it's fractured. That
by saying right here, counsel, can I ask a question?
Sure.
By saying previously welded, is there any distinction in the report that there were factory welds versus some after factory weld?
No, Your Honor, the report doesn't state that. Okay.
Does the report say that there shouldn't be welds at all in a factory seat frame?
No, the report doesn't say that, Judge, but simple.
So I think that's kind of the point that we're getting at in some of these questions. Is there anything in the report itself that puts anybody on notice that there's something different about these welds than might exist at the time it leaves the factory?
The report itself doesn't say that, but I think we can, I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that we have engineers that have looked at this, that they have the ability and the knowledge to check, you know, on how a car is built and how a seat frame is built.
Well, they knew. It just sounds like they didn't put it in writing anywhere.
Right. Exactly. Okay. But I mean, all I can do is tell you what the report says.
All right.
So, well, and that's the sole basis for the motion to dismiss, because you're resorting to the discovery rule and the basis for the trial court's decision. I mean, so we have to look at what's in the record, and you're saying it's not in the record.
But what's in the record, Judge, is that there is a fractured frame on a seat, and it fractured at the point of a weld. So that is the wrongful cause. And so what the basis of this third party complaint is that this fractured weld somehow contributed to causing the plaintiff's injuries. So they're on notice. They have this knowledge of a wrongful cause at the time of the inspection, which carries over to when counsel appears in the case on August 22nd, 2018. And once they have knowledge that this injury could be wrongfully caused because the weld failed in the seat frame, then they have an obligation to pursue knowledge, to develop knowledge for a cause of action. It doesn't matter who did it. It doesn't matter when it was done. It's done. It's knowledge that you have that could contribute and cause the injuries to the plaintiff. Therefore, you have an obligation to conduct your discovery and make your determinations running from that point in time.
Mr. Gustafson, do you acknowledge that or concede that the expert's report does not foreclose the possibility that this was a factory weld?
The report doesn't say one way or the other, Your Honor.
Okay.
It doesn't say one way or the other.
By inference, then, are we at a point where somebody should have asked? We can just figure out who should have asked or should have been alerted. And maybe you had to talk to the manufacturer. Maybe that question had to be asked of the manufacturer.
Well, Judge, I believe that that's why you have a retained consultant who looks at the seat frame and knows vehicles and can get the drawings, can get the manufacturing specs for the vehicle, and can determine how a frame is built originally, and can also determine from parts and serial numbers whether this was an original seat or not an original seat. The point is, they could have done those things, but there's no record that they did anything.
Mr. Gustafson, is your argument and the argument that you made in support of your motion to dismiss dependent on this not having been a factory weld?
No, it's not dependent on that at all. It's an apparent, clear piece of evidence, Judge, that a weld existed on the frame of the seat and that the weld fractured. And the report says because of this accident. That's the information. When and who did it really doesn't matter, because what matters is you have that knowledge right at the beginning of free suit, but then that knowledge carries over and you have an obligation to perform discovery and to investigate, to determine those things. You've got 2 years to do it.
They and in order to be wrongfully caused, according to your theory, we have to accept that a weld should not fail.
Correct.
If it does fail, then that is wrongfully caused.
Correct. And just like in the airbag situation that I believe one of the judges provided a hypothetical to, once it's discovered that the airbag didn't activate, you have to follow up and investigate. And determine when, what was the cause of it not activating. The fact that it didn't activate, though, is the wrongful cause. And therefore, the statute begins to run. And that's what we have here. We know there's a wrongful cause. As Judge Baber even determined, it's clear, it's objective, that we have a failed well. That's what they knew. It doesn't matter who did it. That's not the analysis under the statute of limitations and the discovery rule. Counsel argues that they didn't have enough information. It's their job to develop the information, to discover the information, to investigate. I hate to jump around, but there was some, when we talk about, the timeline involved in this matter, we have the accident in October of 2017, the inspections December of 2017. There are letters that between counsel for the plaintiff and counsel for the defendant from trucking pre-suit leading up to the point when the lawsuit is filed, stating that they want to do pre-suit to discovery regarding the repairs done to the car, that they are requesting an immediate depth regarding repair of the car seat. And these are letters from February of 2018, April of 2018, and May of 2018, right when the lawsuit is filed. Because even plaintiff's counsel is saying, I know you want to depose the plaintiff early because you want to get information about the repair to the car seat.
When
this is all happening.
I apologize. When is the earliest acknowledgement there that you just referenced that it was a repair to the seat?
There's a letter, February 7, 2018.
That's the earliest, is that right?
Correct, Judge. And that's pre-suit, or February 2018. I don't know if I said 17. It's February 7, 2018. And then it's followed up in April of 2018 and May of 2018. There are letters back and forth recognizing the importance of it, of determining repairs done to the car, and wanting to depose the plaintiff on that issue. And then nothing happens. Defense counsel files their appearance in August of 2018. They don't send discovery to the plaintiff until 5 months later. And the discovery that they send doesn't ask specifically about welding. When was the seat welded? When was welding repairs performed on the seat frame? It asked for repairs in general. They don't request the plaintiff's deposition until May 16 of 2019, after stating in February of 2018 and April of 2018 how important it is to depose the plaintiff immediately. They don't send out a notice until May 16 of 2019, setting the deposition for July 8 of 2019. they don't, after they get the answers to the written discovery, which discloses the repair facilities, there are three of them that have performed repairs on this car, they don't subpoena records from those repair facilities for another 7 months. And then when they get the records, the record from my client, from Smith & Allen Garage, which counsel referenced, identifies that the car's seat track was replaced. They know that the focus of this case and the from the examination of the seat is all about this seat frame, and yet they don't bother to subpoena anyone from Smith & Allen Garage about this invoice that shows a seat track has been replaced. They don't know what it means, but they don't bother to depose anyone to find out. They don't subpoena them for a deposition, and they don't take the plaintiff's deposition until September of 2020. And they offer as an excuse for not taking the plaintiff's deposition that he was in a nursing home and there was COVID. Well, there is a tremendous amount of time. A year and a half goes by before COVID comes in March of 2020. And then after COVID, we haven't even gotten into that issue, but there's a whole issue about, you know, equitable tolling, which I argue in my brief was not brought, argued, and it's waived because it wasn't brought up in any of the briefs. But their plaintiffs are appellant is arguing that these excuses for why the discovery wasn't done. And then they say that they didn't find out enough information that Smith & Allen repaired this car seat, did the weld, until they took the plaintiff's deposition. Well, again, the only thing they obtain in the deposition of the plaintiff is the who. They find out, well, Smith & Allen welded the car seat. Again, finding out who has nothing to do with the running of the statute of limitations.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Your time is up.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel for the appellant, rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, first of all, there's a lot of arguing of facts by counsel for the appellee, which to me speaks to the heart of this issue in many respects, that this issue is something that the trier fact should decide.
Mr. Heffelfinger, let me interrupt you here. Mr. Gustafson referenced two letters, one February 2018, one in April 2018, and I'm just looking at his brief, page 3. He says plaintiff's counsel wrote to defendant's attorney, I don't know if that was you or somebody else, on April the 19th, 2018. And in that letter stated, quote, since you are requesting an immediate deposition and follow-up regarding the repair of the car seat and so on, it identifies in that letter repair of the car seat. So it would seem that there was information, at least in the form of that letter, that would confirm that there was a problem with the car seat, that this wasn't an original factory weld that had broken, but there was somebody here, plaintiff's counsel, is noting a suspicion that there was a problem with the car seat and that it had been repaired. What do you say to that?
I think your use of suspicion is a good word here, because the question is, we were trying to, the question of whether it was repaired and whether the plaintiff had any knowledge of the repairs. And it's all it is a suspicion. That's it. That's all we knew. That was the hunch, if you will. And those letters resulted in Mr. Robertson, Mr. Hardery's counsel, to go ahead and then file suit There's a reference from him basically implying that, hey, if you want to do this, let's just go ahead and get sued, basically saying that I'm not going to allow this deposition that you want to proceed right now.
Thank you.
Counsel, it looks like, Mr. Heffelfinger, it looks like we have lost Justice Connect. His internet probably has malfunctioned in some fashion. I don't know whether he's able to hear us or not. If we could perhaps take a moment to find out what exactly is going on there. Do you have any objection to that?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Gustafson or Mr. Barnett, do you have any objection if we break for a moment to find out what the situation is with Justice Connect?
No, Judge.
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. All right. Mr. Heffelfinger, we're going to give you 3 minutes, which adds about 30 seconds on to the time that you actually had, because I think it took us about 30 seconds to realize that Justice Connect wasn't with us anymore and to get that resolved. So you can start up where you wish. You're on mute, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. Just briefly, the argument from the appellee ignores the Knox College versus Celotex case. I think that case is particularly important for the analysis here. 6 years go by, and the Supreme Court specifically said that the independent consultant identifying Celotex was at least in part enough to defeat the dismissal of the complaint. Here, we have a weld that's discovered that is broken after the accident. And the question becomes is why? And just like in Knox College, there is 6 years go by, there was time spent trying to determine the why. Written discovery was propounded. The plaintiff, who has the requisite knowledge, in fact, testified that he sat in the seat and it broke, resulting in him taking the vehicle to Steve Smith Mountain Garage, at which time it was welded. Doesn't identify anything in his answers to interrogatories. What more are we supposed to do at that point? We issue subpoenas. Those subpoenas come in, and the one from Steve Smith Mountain Garage, the Appellee's counsel said it says the seat track was replaced. That's not true. The invoice, April 5, 2015, says the seat track was repaired. That's markedly different than saying the seat was replaced or a weld occurred. There's nothing in those REC 49 invoices that identify anything specific to welding or replacement of the seat. Furthermore, that particular invoice doesn't even tell us which seat was involved, which seat track was even involved. So in the end, all we had as of 12/7/17 was suspicion. Writing the letters, obviously, it spoke at some level to the recognition that we're trying to figure out the why. And suit was filed, and the process of suit then runs its course. And then the bottom line is the deposition of the plaintiff would have been taken in May. This information would have been discovered. The claim would have been filed.
Well, wouldn't the why be the seat track broke? What you're actually looking for is how or who.
No, the seat track was not involved in this accident at all, Your Honor.
Well, but your knowledge at that point, based on your expert's reports, was
the other thing to clarify real quick, the Semke forensic report that they're referring to, that's the plaintiff's report, not our report. I want to make sure that's clear in the record. That's not our report. But the bottom line is we get the records, and the question becomes, they're critical of us for not taking a deposition. The question is, what was a good faith basis to take the deposition? We had answers interrogatories from the plaintiff that didn't identify any work, and then we have invoices that don't identify any work, either welding or replacing a seat. We were still basically at square one. We weren't in a position to know until we took the plaintiff's deposition. We took it as quickly as we could under the circumstances, and 5 days thereafter, we sought leave to file because we had information as to potentially to the why.
Thank you, counsel. Thank all counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.